You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today with WHQR station manager Cleve Callison, whose last day at the station is set for July 21st. And that may be one of the reasons he agreed to join us on the show today as a guest to talk about not his tenure at the station, but his familial ties to the Confederacy. Raised in Gaffney, South Carolina, and steeped in the Southern Baptist culture, Cleve is exploring the complexities of loving and respecting family members while being aware of their fight to perpetuate the oppression of fellow human beings. The phone lines are open on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Cleve, just before we went to break, I read an email from Jane who has had a family member who was involved in the Confederacy, and she talks about reading his diaries and how so much of what he did was just about his civil service. It was not about working to perpetuate the enslavement of other people.
Right. And I think that was something that was at issue for a number of people who joined the Confederate armies. They felt that they were defending their homeland, even though the South actually started the fighting with the bombardment of Fort Sumter, feeling like the South was being invaded by Northern armies. And I did look up some information. Particularly, I was a little bit more familiar with the history in South Carolina, which overall was very secessionist. I think there were – South Carolina is the only state where there was not a county or a region that didn't in turn secede from the state that was seceding from the Union. You know, you had the Free State of Franklin in or is that – I may be confusing that with something else. But there were, I know there were counties in Alabama, for example, that seceded from Alabama when Alabama seceded from the Union. South Carolina did not. It was thoroughly secessionist, pretty much top to bottom. North Carolina was interesting because there's – some historians would say that most North Carolinians, would, given the choice to vote, would not have voted to secede. There was, in fact, scheduled to be the equivalent of a referendum in the state, which as after the South Carolina Act of Secession, the legislature manipulated it so that that referendum never took place and the legislature itself voted for secession. In the election of 1860, Abraham Lincoln was not on the ballot in North Carolina. But most – there were other people who were on the ballot, and together those unionists, that is against secession, outvoted the secessionist candidate, the Democrat. So there's plenty of evidence that particularly once you get farther west in North Carolina, slavery became less and less important, and they were – but once the state had voted to secede, North Carolina people volunteered. North Carolina suffered, I believe, more casualties than any other state in the Confederacy during the Civil War. And clearly they saw it as, you know, my state, without looking at whether my state is on the wrong side or not, it's my state, and so I'm going to volunteer to support it. So I certainly understand that, that sentiment. I do want to mention one thing, though. We were talking about slavery, and there's one quote that I think is really kind of key. The South Carolina Ordinance of Secession basically doesn't directly refer to slaves. It talks about the rights of slaveholding states. So that's really one of the few references. But it's very clear from the secessions in other states that they knew what this was. The Mississippi Secession Declaration says, "Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest in the world." So that was it. And the economy of the South was totally built on slaves. It was probably greater in dollar volume than the economy of the North, built on manufacturing.
So what would you say to people like Jane? And there are many of them, and this is why I'm spending a lot of time on her email, because this kind of exemplifies this paradox that we try to deal with when we talk about this country's Confederate history. So her personal ties to it, she says, you know, she visited the cemetery where he was buried as a little girl, and She regrets that some of the Confederate statues and monuments are being removed. She says they were erected to assuage the pain that so many families felt upon losing loved ones and friends in military service. And she says our present sensitivity to issues of race are also important, and I do try to understand those concerns, but I am still proud of my great-great-grandfather for his bravery and his willingness to fight for his family and what he believed in.
Well, I'm not going to argue with her about that. I think there are lots of different dimensions of this to consider. I'm not a firebrand on the issue of statuary and things like that. I think what's missing, though, is the context. You know, we've got statues of my hometown of Gaffney had a Confederate soldier, you know, with his rifle facing northward, sort of saying, "I dare you to invade." But what's missing is the context. I mean, where are the monuments about slavery, the monuments about particularly that, but also other aspects of life in the South? And I would take issue with the fact that these statues were erected to honor those people. That may be part of it. But they were also erected not at the time of the Civil War. They were erected around the turn of the century when Jim Crow was being codified into law, removing the right to vote from blacks, removing them from public office, intimidating them from voting. And the 1898 insurrection here in Wilmington was a direct result of the activity of the red shirts and people at that time.
What you're saying is you cannot tease apart the ideas behind the Confederacy from the continued expression of racism in this country in different forms.
It was a fatal blight, a cancer on the whole society. And people were in denial then, and some people are still in denial about that, including a number of folks that I know from my hometown who look on and you know, I know it looks like we have some phone calls, but, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about my hometown and about my grandfather and his history, which we haven't talked about yet.
Former Attorney General of South Carolina.
Right. He was Tolliver Callison, and I'm Tolliver Callison III, so I was named for him. And he was the Attorney General of South Carolina in the 1950s, where he was often in federal court or even at the Supreme Court battling people like Thurgood Marshall over issues relating to civil rights.
And we'll get more into that in just a moment. You're listening to Coastline. Should southern states continue the trend of taking down Confederate memorials from places of honor and perhaps moving them to museums, or is that a form of cultural genocide? Cleve Callison is our guest today. He's WHQR's soon-to-be-retired station manager. His great-great-grandfather was a Confederate officer. His grandfather was South Carolina's attorney general. We'll hear more about him in a moment. And James Callison's grave bears the initials CSA, Confederate States of America. We're taking your questions on this live Wednesday show at 910-343-1138. And we're also reading your emails at coastline@whqr.org. Alan from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I'd like to start off by thanking Cleve and sending them off with a great farewell. Thank you very much for your time at the station.
Thank you, Alan.
And I just wanted to say that these Confederate monuments, like as a Wilmingtonian born and raised, these Confederate monuments do need to go. Baby boomer generation has been the one complaining about millennials getting participation trophies. That's all these monuments are. They're participation trophies. In Germany, they don't glorify Nazi ancestors for their past atrocities. And anybody defending keeping someone in chains is absolutely dishonorable, completely despicable. And so that monument for George Davis is a lie. It's a complete and total fabrication of history, and that's the real cultural genocide. They need to go now.
Where do you think they need to go, Alan? That take the monument to George Davis,
I
for example.
I believe across the river is a place called Southern Metals Recycling. And you can get a lot of money for good brass.
Thank you so much for your call, Alan. Appreciate that. We're talking with Cleve Callison, WHQR station manager, who has personal ties to the Confederacy. We're talking about how he processes this as a baby boomer. And Cleve, we mentioned the fact that your grandfather was South Carolina's Attorney General, and he argued against the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1957.
One of the things I did in preparation for the show is I went and looked that up, and there are pages and pages of his testimony. And you sort of have to filter it through kind of the language, the artificial language, but as I was listening to it, I was trying to imagine his voice. He had this very courtly, mellow, very genteel, very Southern-mannered voice and way of speaking. But he was basically saying to Congress, which was contemplating the 1957 Civil Rights Act, there's no problem between the races in South Carolina. We get along just fine, and we have our own way of doing things, which is different from the Northern way of doing things. So we think you should just let us alone and solve our own problems. Yes, it's true we've had some lynchings in the past, but we haven't had any in the last several years. And as a prosecutor, he prosecuted lynchings. You know, people
prosecuted
who,
people who perpetrated lynchings.
So it's interesting to read that and see some of this, because some of the language is kind of guarded and coded, and I think that's still an issue with us. Alan, the caller, said that, you know, people – that slavery is indefensible. I don't hear anybody defending slavery. But what they do is sort of mute or mitigate or forget the idea that slavery was the root of this. It's not – you'll hear people saying, as they did in the 19th century, yes, slavery is a positive good because we're helping this benighted race of people that, you know, had no future in Africa, and statements like that. You don't hear that today. You hear even – very conservative people honoring Martin Luther King and the things that he did. But still, there's a cognitive dissonance, I think, for people when you say, I honor my ancestor who fought for the Confederacy.
So then talk to us about your own cognitive dissonance. Take your grandfather, since he's someone that you knew. When you think back to being a little boy and knowing your grandfather, what kind of a relationship did you have with him, and how did you feel towards him?
Well, of course, I didn't see him in any kind of political context at all. You know, when he died in 1966, when I was about 20 years old, and I am – you mentioned baby boomer. I was born in 46, so I am, you know, one of the first class of baby boomers. But, you know, when we would get together for family gatherings and things around the ancestral home – by the way, that home in Lexington, South Carolina was – General Sherman's headquarters when he was bombarding Columbia. I don't know if you and I talked about that.
We didn't.
Yeah. Somewhere I have a letter. It's probably in the same box with the Red Shirts Remembered book from an adjutant to General Sherman, written to my grandfather after 1900 sometime, talking about his party had – I don't know if Sherman himself lived in that house, but some of his officers and did – when they were besieging Columbia. Anyway, where was I?
That's your ancestral home.
That's the ancestral home. But I see my grandfather, remember my grandfather, just in the context of family visits. And he was a very quiet and reserved, very Southern Baptist, you know, no smoking, no drinking, probably no dancing, you know, never saw any of that happening. But not ever in any kind of political context. That only came later. I mean, we knew he was the Attorney General, but it wasn't ever in the context of what was his position on civil rights and the impact of that.
How close was he to your immediate family? Did you see him once a week or a couple times a week or a month? Or what were your boyhood?
Probably once every 3 or 4 months. We lived in upstate in Gaffney, South Carolina, and you know, it was only a couple of hours by car, but we didn't get down there. We kids didn't like going on Christmas Day because it meant we had to stop playing with our toys to go down there. So, but that's a different thing. But, the family was reasonably close, but they were all very reserved. I mean, they were not demonstrable people at all.
He wasn't openly affectionate with you.
No, but I mean, he was genial and he enjoyed having his grandchildren around. But one thing I mentioned to you, my grandmother always referred to him when we were there as Mr. Callison. She never called him by his first name. She would say, Mr. Callison, so-and-so.
And for people who've never heard that kind of address, what does that – is that Southern gentility or what does that express?
I don't know if that's still around at all. I doubt if anybody still does that. But they were people of their age and their generation. And I mean, when I look back at this, I wonder what people are going to think about us two or three generations from now looking back at us. Are they going to see us as, oh, these poor, benighted people? I mean, can you believe it? They were still eating animals back then, you know, or something like that. Things that we take for granted now because it's just part of our culture, but a different culture in a different time is going to say, oh, no, that's not politically correct or whatever. And you're tempted to say, why didn't people realize the evil of slavery? They were surrounded by it. Well, they were surrounded by it. It was like the air that you breathe. It just felt totally normal. And to me, growing up, you know, having white drinking fountains and colored drinking fountains, it was part of the environment. And I'm sure I must have wondered why we did that, but that was just what you were surrounded by when I was a kid.
And
growing
so,
up in the South.
So then today, as Cleve Callison today, how do you process that? Do you have feelings about your grandfather? Do you think, I mean...
Well, I have affectionate feelings about him, yes. He was my grandfather, and he was always very kindly. You know, I never heard him raise his voice. I never heard him say a harsh word. He enjoyed having his grandchildren around. But there was this other, you know, his professional life was defending black people getting thrown off buses and arguing against the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1957.
Which was primarily a voting rights act.
It was voting rights, but there was also an anti-lynching provision, and I believe that's the one that eliminated the poll tax, which prevented a lot of blacks from registering to vote.
And
so, can we sum it up by saying it's complicated?
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM and 98.9 in Myrtle Beach. We're talking with soon-to-be-retired station manager Cleve Callison about his family ties to the Confederacy. Margie from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me. And Cleve, thank you so much for your years serving WHQR and by that the broader community. Really good term of service.
Oh, thank you, Margie.
I am calling because I am a frequent visitor to Columbia, South Carolina, and was there shortly after the Confederate flag was removed from the State House. And what followed in the wake of that removal was the city's concerted effort to draw more attention to black history and black people of history, so that when you walk down, particularly Main Street in Columbia, you are encountering monuments, plaques, observances of significant moments in history that were all black and all overlooked. So that instead of just addressing how do we cover the white history, Confederate history, it's really looking at how we don't recognize black history. And I might add that it always bothers me, no matter what city I drive to, they have a Martin Luther King Parkway Drive or Road. Why must ours also be Martin Luther King? Why can't it be Althea Gibson or something of a person of color, a black person who has some significant and local history that's a little bit more germane than Martin Luther King, with all due respect to Martin Luther King?
Well, there are just wonderful examples of black culture and contributions to culture here in Wilmington. And I agree with you that you know, I've certainly heard of Althea Gibson, and it's not as if she's unknown here, but yeah, you're right. There are many people who don't get the prominence that King gets.
Margie, thank you so much for that call. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM and 98.9 in Myrtle Beach. It's a conversation with WHQR station manager Cleve Callison about his upbringing in the South, his family ties to the Confederacy, and how he views his own relatives and the trend to remove Confederate monuments from places of honor. After this break, you'll have one more segment to call in with your own question for Cleve. The number during this live Wednesday show is 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.